So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show today, the BBC announces cuts as Director General Tim Davie faces up to his licence fee freeze. We'll find out what's on the chopping block. The Daily Telegraph hits record subscription figures as the UK press ponders the future of news amid the cost of living squeeze. Plus, disinformation journalist Cheyenne Sadar Izadeh shares the BBC's latest efforts to combat fake news. And in the media quiz, we find out who's been making up for media faux pas. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. In this week's news, the BBC and the Attorney General went to court over the details of a story involving an allegedly abusive MI5 informant. The BBC was given permission to broadcast the story, but without revealing the identity of the accused. We also had Partygate leaks continuing to emerge from across the press, from ITV to BBC's Panorama, culminating in Sue Gray Day. Meanwhile, over on the stock market, shares of Snapchat owner Snap plunged more than 40% on Tuesday, dragging down a lot of its rivals too. And Ricky Gervais was in the spotlight after jokes in his new Netflix special continued his habit of punching down to the LGBT community. The comedian defended the need for taboo comedy, whilst critics are calling for the platform to enforce its policies and remove the potentially harmful content. But onto the media stories you need to know about this week. I've got two media experts here to take us through the headlines. So first up, we've got the co-founder of production company Darth Doris. It's Jamie East. Hi, Jamie.
Hey, Matt. How you doing?
I'm good. Last time I saw you was in Sweden, and you were telling the audio and radio masses about the Smart 7. Why not tell our masses about it too?
It's a daily news podcast that tells you seven things you need to know. It's 7 in the morning, 7 minutes long. We designed it for the daily commute the week before the first lockdown hit. We decided to crack on and launch it anyway because no one had anything else to do. And we did 10 million downloads a couple of weeks ago. So it's been great. We've expanded into Germany, into Ireland, and got a fitness one, got an entertainment one coming. You know, it's all good. It's all good.
I mean, 10 million is not bad for a lockdown project, is it?
It's been nice that people have adopted it as part of their daily habit. It was always seen as something we knew we'd always struggle to get people to replace their existing kind of commuting podcast habit with a new one. So we designed this to be just the thing that they listen to on the way to the train station or on the way to the bus stop. And they seem to be going really well.
That's good. Also with us is Press Gazette editor Charlotte Tobit. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me back.
No worries. It's, I'm sure, your favourite time of the month when the ABCs are out. What's the latest? Who's doing well?
It's got to be a slightly samey story, as I'm sure you can imagine, that there's, as people always discuss, just industry-wide decline in print. However, I'd say the winners in April were the Daily Mail and the Daily Mirror. Both grew ever so slightly month on month, which obviously is bucking the trends slightly. But then what I also found interesting was the freeze are still staying steady and solid or even growing. Their distribution's obviously it's slightly different. It's not a paid print circulation, but the Metro and City AM are both sort of doing well, I think, certainly by their print metric. They're not having to panic and put less copies out at the moment.
I mean, it's still a challenge for them, isn't it? Yeah, everyone with their phones out on the tube in the morning, slightly different to 20 years ago, picking up a copy of the Metro before they go on their journey.
Especially where you've got, for example, parts of the Jubilee line now where even underground you can get 4G. So I'm sure the owners of those papers weren't too happy when that got introduced.
Change is always at the forefront of the media, and today is no different. This week is no different. On Thursday, the BBC announced a digital-first strategy for the broadcaster, and there seems to be kind of quite a lot of chatter and confusion about what the changes mean. This is Director General Tim Davey making some announcements. Jamie, what have we heard from the BBC about what they're going to be cutting?
Well, I think the headline that everyone will take away is that they're scything through some of the they class the smaller digital stations. So CBBC, I think Radio 4 Extra and BBC 4, I think, were the ones that I think will garner the most attention. The BBC always do this. They announce a ton of cuts and then the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. And then they also announce that they've just signed on Chris Kamara. Millions of tons of talent have joined BBC Sounds, which gives you some indication where they're placing their chips for the next kind of 5 years, I would say. They can't do right for doing wrong, and there isn't a lot that they could have done. I think anyone in Tim Davies' position would probably have done the same thing. There will be lots of emotional outcry at CBBC going off and this, that. But, you know, you have to be pragmatic. I very much doubt the figures for something like CBBC or Radio 4 Extra on a linear platform warrant the costs, you know, even just the compliance costs of all of that wouldn't have been worth it. And, you know, the kind of U-turn of putting BBC Three back on linear, I would argue, probably wasn't a great idea. They should have doubled down and stuck to their guns. I think they're always panicking about having a Six Music BBC Asian Network style protest and furore about that. But I think in reality, they're doing the right thing. All of these channels deserve to still find ears and eyes, but not on linear TV where the costs are just abhorrent and just wasteful. If the BBC knows how to do one thing, it's to waste money.
All they needed was 285 million of cuts, and actually they found 500 million, but they're investing more into digital. I mean, Charlotte, from a journalism perspective, there's potentially quite a bit of cuts coming to local and regional BBC. Do we know what's likely to disappear or change?
Yes. So, interestingly to note first that there were only just quite a lot of cuts to journalism in the regions in about 2020, or announced in 2020 anyway. So, for example, as well, the long-running current affairs programme Inside Out was cut at that time. And then about at the start of this year, they introduced a replacement called We Are England. That has now been cut after only a few months. So that obviously wasn't working in the way they hoped it would. In addition, local TV news bulletins in some areas seem to be being cut. For example, BBC South Today Oxford and also Look East Cambridge, that operation, and coverage of that region is going to be moved to Norwich, apparently. So this is all part of this drive to go digital first. So essentially what they're saying is they're not necessarily cutting investment in journalism overall, but that less will be in TV and radio and more will be online. But I must say, I had quite a funny conversation with someone I was with earlier when I said they were going to be a digital first BBC. They said, well, haven't they said they're going to be a digital first BBC many times already? So it is interesting that that's sort of still the stage we're at, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's a bravery thing, isn't it? It's exactly the same as, you know, any form of media, whether it be print, whether it be music, whether it be television, SVOD, it's the changing of the old guard. You know, music went through a horrible kind of transitionary period over a decade and has come out arguably in ruder health, and print is still clinging on, and the BBC is still clinging on. It's just the changing of, you know, it's like moving away from the print press to Photoshop. It takes that long to kind of shift that giant industry over, it takes bravery and kind of, I guess, being quite thick-skinned about doing it. There is going to be blood lost. There always is. But it inevitably, it just has to happen. None of the lists that they've made, you know, creating a single 24-hour TV news channel is just perfect common sense. The fact that they had so much going on anyway was just ludicrous. It makes sense from an editorial point of view and from a financial point of view as well. The fact they've managed to find £500 million of savings when they're only asked to save 285 goes to show just how much money is washing around in the BBC, I think.
There is still a lot. I mean, when you look at some of the shifts, so they're moving BBC Four online. Jamie, if you were going to write the channel's obituary, its broadcast obituary, what would you include? What's it going to be remembered for?
I think BBC Four was great, or is great, was great. Did they kind of accidentally invent slow TV? Did they do that weekend? I think that was the great one where they... wouldn't someone just fly around the coast of Britain, really, in like real time? And it was great, you know. No one watched it, but, you know, it's nice to know it's there. It's like the shipping forecast, isn't it? You know, no one uses the shipping forecast, really, you know, but it's, you always know it's there. So BBC Four was good at that. And you did tend to find stuff on there. Music found a good home on BBC Four as well. A lot of music documentaries, a lot of music programming. And the spillover of things like Glastonbury into there were great.
And all those old episodes of Top of the Pops, of course, as well. Charlotte, we see BBC, it's probably less of an issue maybe than BBC Four. This is an audience that are pretty iPlayer first. And I think if you talk to a 7 or 8 year old, they're somewhat surprised about the idea of linear television, somebody else choosing what you should watch. That's the right thing to do, isn't it? Probably move that channel to just be on iPlayer.
Yeah, I think it completely makes sense. I wasn't surprised by that one. And it's sort of like what Jamie was saying just now about maybe the BBC should have stuck to its guns on keeping BBC Three. CBBC viewers are the viewers who are forming even more online habits than young BBC Three viewers. So in that sense, it completely makes sense. I think the only thing maybe the BBC should be wary of is that obviously they are meant to be for everyone. And I don't have figures with me, unfortunately, but I wonder if there are like families who, you know, can't afford smart TVs and iPads and stuff, if they'll find it harder to access that content if it's not on TV. But yeah, I don't know. I just, that would be my one concern.
If you're 70 plus with a kind of a slightly dodgy broadband plan and that you don't really understand watching, you know, the TV through the internet, it means kind of less stuff for you though, doesn't it, Jamie? Or have we abandoned those, that audience? They're going to be paying the license fee anyway, so tough.
I think it's the transition thing. You know, BBC Three, CBBC, BBC Four, generally pretty kind of either young or kind of middle-aged but internet savvy kind of demos, all of those ones. They know what they're doing. You know, I mean, look, there'd be outcry if they did it for BBC Two or for Radio Two or something like that. There'd be, you know, the silver foxes of the world would go absolutely crazy about it, and understandably so. But this is a way of transitioning their audience, or at least, are they moving an audience onto online, or are they just going where the audience are already? I suspect it's a bit of both. And like you say, Charlotte, they're not going to lose any young audience from closing the linear CBBC down. I get what you mean about access, but they have to make a start somewhere. You know, license fee existed, you know, colour TV, they ploughed millions and millions into making colour programming before hardly anybody had colour TVs. You have to make that leap somewhere.
Other things that they're going to be changing is taking 5 Live off AM, shutting down Radio 4's Long Wave, which they seem to talk about every few years anyway. Last time talking about valves being in short supply, it sounded slightly dodgy, but that's off too. And some of these changes are going to take a few years to come through. When we talk about digital change though, The Telegraph's been doing pretty well. It's announced digital subscription growth of 40%. Charlotte, they've been doing pretty well digitally, haven't they?
Yeah, really well. Basically for a while now, they've focused so much on subscriptions only over traffic and just print newsstand sales, and it's clearly working. They do have a big target, which is to have 1 million paying subscribers and 10 million registered users by the end of 2023. So registered users are people who have like signed up for email newsletters and things like that. And they're currently over 744,000. So I think they're feeling pretty confident in their position. The whole way through the COVID pandemic, they grew profits. And I think, to be honest, they're actually a really good example of subscriptions, dub right.
Jamie, are you a Telegraph subscriber?
I'm not actually. I don't know why I'm not. I should be, I suppose. I think, you know, I worked for a number of years for News UK and for wireless and on print and across broadcast and radio. And they've just done it right. You know, it's same as the Times. You know, the Times is another success in terms of subscriptions, whether or not it's as profitable as it remains to be seen. You know, and I'm trying to think of an audio equivalent. I guess Tortoise would be an online audio equivalent of actually what happens when you just stick to your guns. And it's the same as everything. They've concentrated on content. You know, I know, you know, Robbie Collins at the Telegraph, for instance, a lot of their film writers, they cover film in a way that very few other British publications do, with the exception of Empire and arguably the Sunday Times. And it's paid off. You know, people are subscribing, and it sounds like such a base element thing to say, but, you know, I'm sure we've all been in millions of meetings with CEOs and editors and all the rest of it, where you try and hit them with the content stick and it's like, yeah, but surely there's another way. Surely there's another way. It's like, no, there's really not another way. You just have to make good stuff that people want to read. It's not that tricky. Yet that concept seems to elude a hell of a lot of, certainly the dailies.
I mean, for Smart 7, that's kind of an ad-funded proposition. Is on your roadmap an element of subscription, be it sort of forced or voluntary? Is that something you think about?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult not to. You know, I think that's certainly where podcasts are heading with, you know, integration with Apple and Acast, who are our platform providers, have got a great kind of subscription element to them as well. It will happen eventually. Daily news? No. I mean, why would anyone pay for daily news? It's there, it's everywhere, it's omnipresent. People would just go, even if it was 10p, they'd be going, well, I can just go and get this. I can just listen to Tortoise, or I can go and listen to any number of things. It doesn't matter how good we package it. But that's not to say that there isn't an opportunity to expand the brand into stuff like that. We're a short form audio proposition. So to get people to expect people to pay for it, I'm not sure they will pay for 7 minutes. You know, that would have to be one hell of a 7 minutes. Who knows?
Charlotte, we've talked a lot about subscription on the podcast, with that kind of Netflix and Disney Plus and all of that, with press subscriptions, you know, and I hit the paywall sometimes on the Telegraph, and I don't think I'd want to subscribe to the Telegraph. It's not necessarily my thing. It does slightly annoy me when maybe I can't read those things. I'm used to getting it for free. But, you know, cost of living crisis and all that, do you think people are going to scale back some of these subscriptions, some of the success that press has had? Do you think they might see their subscribers dropping a little bit?
I think that is the risk this year, yeah. But for titles targeting more affluent audiences, I suppose, like the Telegraph and the Times, maybe it will be less of a problem than if they were targeting a lower demographic audience and not an ABC One audience. But then the lower demographics are the ones that have struggled to build subscription propositions anyway. In times like these, with the cost of living crisis, but also with the Ukraine ongoing and all sorts to do with the government, and although Partygate, it might be technically over, there's still lots of questions about Boris Johnson's longevity, I suppose. With all of that context, I do think that where people can, they will want to keep a trusted news source. I think if they're the type of person that has decided to sign up to a Telegraph or Times or FT or Economist subscription anyway, I think maybe they would want to cut other things first, but you know, who knows? I could be completely wrong on that.
Be a big argument over the dinner table. Is it Disney Plus or is it the Telegraph?
Which one goes? Jodie, 9-year-old, what do you want to keep? Disney Plus or the Telegraph or Chopper? So picking up on what you've just said there, I think at the telecom conference, they were saying that everything's going to end up being posh news for posh people. Is that right then?
Well, it was raised as a possibility, which I think does often come up in the subscription question and is a good thing for us as an industry to sort of stay aware of. It was raised at a panel with some sort of top media executives, and the chief commercial officer at the FT sort of basically admitted it's a feasible outcome, but said it's not a desirable thing if that would happen. But he said it's feasible, you'd be subsidizing essentially mass journalism with the subscriptions. But then, so the other people on the panel were not so subscription based as the FT, and they all said, no, we completely disagree. We're still putting out legitimate trusted news that people are consuming. without subscriptions, there's still lots of trusted news out there that will serve the people that can't afford to pay. People that were saying that were future chief executive, Guardian's interim chief executive. They were saying, obviously, they've got the donations model, so people that like what they do sort of essentially pay so that people that can't afford to pay can still read it because it doesn't have to go subscription-based. So they're saying this model works to make sure that trusted news isn't only posh news for posh people.
Thanks, bye.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And onto our deep dive this week. Early today, I spoke to BBC disinformation journalist Cheyenne Sadar-Izadeh all about what it's like responding to breaking news events such as the recent Texas shooting.
Yeah, so like most editorial teams, we have an editorial meeting in the morning with, you know, everybody, every journalist in the team and our editors, our duty editor for the day. And then we run through the stories that we're seeing. I'm usually the night owl in the team. I'm the person who sort of stays up until like 2 or 3, 4 in the morning and looks at stories, usually the ones that are brewing up in the States. There are also other journalists who get up early in the morning and look at stories that are, you know, in Europe and in other parts of the world as the day starts. And then we gather there in the meeting and then we say, okay, this is something that we've seen. For instance, like, you know, yesterday we were saying, okay, this shooting has happened and we're seeing this narrative being formed online and it's been shared by this politician and this member of Congress and it's false. Okay, and then the obvious question would be, why is it false and how many people are seeing this? Do we have any idea how widespread this is?
Can we use that example of the Texas shooting? So obviously the event happens, there's some kind of breaking news on traditional outlets, and then what sort of places are starting to jump on this and putting their own inaccurate spin on what they see?
Places that would usually either benefit from it politically or, you know, you and I know the internet trolls, you know, people who just do it for what is known as the lulz. And they just want to have a bit of a fun and it becomes a habit. And there are places on the internet that actually nurture that type of behavior. You just troll for the sake of trolling. There's tons of them. So one of the examples in the immediate aftermath, we saw images of a trans person going viral on major platforms like Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, on TikTok. And they were claiming that's the shooter. And we sort of looked into it and we figured out it actually came from 4chan. So 4chan, it's one of the major hubs of internet subculture. All sorts of bizarre stuff happen on 4chan. You know, some of it is very innocuous, but also there are aspects of 4chan that are very, very extreme and very, very unsavory. So this particular one just came from a board on 4chan, which is known as POL, P-O-L, which stands for politically incorrect. Which should give you an idea about what sort of topics are discussed there. So somebody just created this idea that this person was the shooter, despite the fact that we had screenshots of the shooter's Instagram and TikTok, and we knew exactly how he looked like. And he was shot dead, obviously, by police officers, police security officers. And this person suddenly on Reddit, who's a Redditor, found themselves facing a torrent of hatred, just because they've been misidentified as the shooter by somebody who was just doing it either because they dislike trans people or they were just sort of trying to troll, or they were just doing it for the sake of doing it. Who knows? But as I say, that's the culture on 4chan.
I was just going to say, well, what you sort of tend to see then is slightly more mainstream, but maybe sort of far right figures pick that up and move that across to Twitter. So someone like Candice Owens, I think, was picking up some of that type of information. And then it sort of gets washed through a load of people, doesn't it? Or it can do.
Absolutely. Once it's found by an influencer, by somebody who's got major impact or has large following, that's it. That's all that is required. And it doesn't necessarily have to be just that person spreading it, as long as it's on, say, your Twitter feed or on Facebook feed and one influencer sees it, that's it. You know, it's going to be all over the place. And we saw it actually, it was even tweeted by a congressman, by actual sitting congressman. And they deleted the tweet. I actually heard it today repeated on the Today program, something similar to what Candace Owens had tweeted. So that's the way it works. It starts on a fringe, smaller platform, usually. Not always. Sometimes it actually starts on a major platform. And sometimes it comes directly from influencers, from politicians. That happens as well. But in this case, it came from a fringe place. And then before he knew it, within an hour, it was all over the internet. And of course, at the end of it, just adding, there's one person who's done nothing wrong, who's facing a torrent of abuse. So that's the dark side of it.
Do you see partly your job to try and nip this in the bud and to stop the spread by pointing out the inaccuracy and hoping that that stems the flow?
Well, I'm realistic about what I can and cannot do. Like, you know, our job as journalists is not to police the internet. We want a free internet. We rely on a free internet to do our jobs as journalists. And the internet has been a wonderful thing in terms of providing this major space for everyone to share their ideas, to basically broaden the narrative outside just the realms of, you know, mainstream politics and mainstream news organizations. So no, our job is not to police the internet. And the job of, you know, what turns up on a major platform is a matter for the tech companies and the social media platforms. They decide what, you know, they want and what they don't want on their platforms. But yes, there is a hope in the sense that when something like this happens and some, you know, innocent person is just checking their online feed to find out, you know, what's going on in Texas, what's happened, who's done it, and they come across this stuff. Because they're not, either they don't know 4chan or they're not going to put in the effort to go and find the exact threat on a very bad and unsavory board on 4chan, we put in the effort to go find that so that, you know, innocent person who's just found this information online can just look at the fact that, by the way, this is where it's come from and it's false and that person that you're angry at has done nothing wrong.
That was Cheyenne Sadar-Izadeh, and if you're interested in hearing more of our chat, including tips on debunking fake news, just head to patreon.com/mediapod. If you're a Patreon subscriber, you'll get access to bonus interview material with media podcast guests each week. Plus, it supports the making of the show. In fact, I met a listener this week who said he was on the verge of doing a Patreon sign-up. So if you too are on the verge of doing a Patreon sign-up, patreon.com/mediapod. Right, we'll be back after this. And on with the show, I've still got Charlotte and Jamie here looking at the media headlines. News about Russian oligarch Alexander Lebedev, who's quit his role at The Independent. Jamie, Russian oligarchs, they're not particularly popular at the moment. Yeah. Why has he stepped down from The Independent?
They just can't get a break, can they? I mean, it's because he's been placed under economic sanctions by Canada for, in quote, directly enabling the Russian war in Ukraine. It means that he's not got any formal role at The Independent anymore. But, you know, I'm sure I'm not alone in being kind of deeply suspicious at the formality of this. The Independent have always said that, you know, he's not had any real input on the business for a while. You know, obviously his son, can we refer to him as Lord Lebedev now? Eugenie is running things. I can see why he's been ostracized and removed. It's a bit of consolidation. It's similar to a man from Chelsea who had to sell. But you just get the feeling they're just circling, you know, they're just circling the runway until it's safe to land again, is my personal take on all of this.
Charlotte, a spokesman for the newspaper claimed Alexander has no role, commercial or otherwise, in the running of the paper. But is his ownership, regardless of all that, just a bit concerning?
I think it's worth noting, by the way, that the actual company he stepped down from was Independent Print Limited. But the company that runs the Independent nowadays is Independent Digital News and Media. So he was still associated with the body that bought the title. But yeah, I mean, it's a sticky question. I'm not one to judge other than, you know, they are Russian oligarchs. The family is reportedly, you know, quite close to Putin.
I mean, do we know any nice media proprietors, any nice billionaire media proprietors? I mean, you know, I don't know. I can't think of one really.
I mean, all media owners have a tangled relationship with governments and governments of the day. I mean, Jamie, you've worked for News Corp. Yeah. Everyone ends up working for Rupert in some way, shape or form at some point. And in probably in your slightly earlier holy moly days, I'm sure there were lots of tip-offs from journalists about dodgy dealings by their bosses and proprietors, right?
Oh, 100%. I mean, but you know, it's the same as it was. It's the same as it always will be. You know, nothing changes at all. I think, you know, I was more concerned when George Osborne was the so-called editor of the Evening Standard. That concerned me more than Lebedev being the proprietor of it. And yeah, having worked for News Corp, News UK, on and off, and Sky when Rupert was still the owner of Sky for many years. So I've spent the vast majority of my professional life probably working for Rupert in some way, shape or form. Not that he would have a clue who I am. And it's a tricky one. It's the balancing act that you look yourself in the mirror and still go to work every day. We just get on with it. I don't think necessarily that any of them are better than any other, really. Yes, I'm sure they all court the, you know, number 10 courts, all of them, as do they when they need Ofcom sorting out. That's just the way it always has been. It's the way it always will be. But it's what you do on the shop floor that makes a difference, I think.
Charlotte, do you think media moguls are kind of immune from regulation and that sort of anybody who's in power in number 10, they don't really want to take on the press barons, even if they're using slightly less ink than they used to?
I think the publishers are in a pretty good position. And yeah, I mean, the newspapers might go to fewer people in print nowadays, but I do think they still have a massive audience online. And so the influence might be slightly different to what it used to be, but it still is there. And also the newspapers themselves in print, even if the wider public is slightly less interested, I think Whitehall and government and people there do still really care what goes on the front pages and sort of like to stay in the good books. Definitely.
Just finally on this, I mean, Jamie, you're in a digital business now. Do you think the press have lost their influence, or as Charlotte said, they've just evolved their influence into different places?
I think that they definitely have lost their influence. You compare it to, you know, the Thatcher era or even the Blair era, how important it was to make sure that you had the sun on your side, or that the, you know, which way is the sun going to go. And I'm sure it's important to either side. I'm sure number 10 care, and I'm sure the newspaper proprietors care. I genuinely believe that we're at a turning point, though, in terms of mood and how, you know, certainly people that are going to be at voting age in 5 years' time are not going to give two hoots about what the editor of The Sun thinks about a potential prime minister. I think that has been a sea change over the past 10 years. But as long as they both keep feeding the machine, then that relationship will never change. I think politicians will be terrified of getting on the wrong side, and proprietors will be terrified of getting on the wrong side of legislation. The problem that the government has is that they're just not up to speed on the media enough. They don't understand the landscape. They understand the landscape even less than newspaper proprietors, for instance. You only have to look at the privatisation of Channel 4 and all the conversations that Nadine Dorris has been having in public to show just how little they even understand the basic technology, let alone the intricacies of publishing to multiple platforms. It's just, it's nuts.
Well, something that every media baron is scared of is the wondrous world of the media quiz. And this week it's entitled Mistakes and Makeups. I'm going to be describing three stories where media companies have made public apologies this week. I'll give you one word from the headline at a time. Just buzz in when you know the story, and you'll buzz in with your name. So, Charlotte, you will say
Charlotte.
And Jamie, you will say?
Jamie.
Right, here we go. Question number one. So I'm going to gradually reveal these words. When you know what the story is, do buzz in. Manchester.
Jamie.
Charlotte.
United. Oh, I think we were just there with Jamie. Jamie.
It was the ticker tape on BBC News, the crawling text where someone was testing a system or a worker was doing something behind the scenes and accidentally put Manchester United rubbish live on air.
It was great. It looked good. I watched the video. I think the next one was something like rain everywhere. And I sort of quite like the kind of like teen speak scroller. Yeah. Maybe that's what they need to jazz up the news channels.
Absolutely. It was like the Steve Martin film, was it LA Story? It was exactly the same thing, wasn't it? The road sign that would just, you know, bored beyond belief.
That is also a brilliant film if you want to go and watch it. You haven't seen LA Story. A great line in that where it's like, some of these houses are nearly 20 years old. Anyway, go watch. Right, question number two. Find phone numbers sharing $150 million, oh Twitter.
Goodness. Oh, God.
No one's got that one. I will reveal the answer then. So this is news from Twitter. US regulators have fined the social media firm after it gave advertisers users' contact information. Charlotte, is this one that you've heard of this week?
Yeah, I have learned it loads about it. It just sounds like an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, so this was Twitter collected users' names and email addresses to use the service, and then they actually allowed advertisers to target those fields without mentioning to users that they might do that. Right, question number three. Here are the words. Upside Down, season four,
Jamie.
Netflix. Jamie, what's this one?
Hopefully it's that season four of Stranger Things is coming to Netflix tomorrow.
That is.
Phew.
And they're going to be, I think, releasing this series in sort of two halves, which seems to be Netflix's new trick to keep engagement up. Are you a Stranger Things fan?
I am. It's a big family favourite in the household. We've been very much looking forward to this. Probably not as much as Netflix have been looking forward to it, though. They've had a rotten old time of it of late. Apart from Better Call Saul and Bridgerton, I think Stranger Things is probably the last remaining kind of champion title that they've got. And that's only got one season left after this one, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's tough for them. Also, Charlotte, they've obviously trying to up their revenue as their subscriber numbers have flailed a little. Are they going to crack down on password sharing? Do you share your Netflix password with anyone?
Well, I use my brother's Netflix password. Don't tell him.
It's like Nadine Dorries all over again.
Yeah. I've got others. Don't worry.
Good. All right. Well, that makes Jamie the winner. It's a 6-month free subscription of Netflix to Jamie, and it's Charlotte having a 6-year backdated invoice from Netflix for your consumption of Stranger Things and everything else. Well done, both of you. That's it for the show today. Jamie, how can people keep up with what you're talking about and the Smart 7?
You can find me on Twitter at Jamie East, or you can just search for the Smart 7 wherever you get your podcasts.
Lovely. And speaking of podcasts, Charlotte, you've been busy at Press Gazette Towers. There's a new podcast that's been birthed. What's it about?
Yes, thanks, Matt. It's called The Future of Media Explained.
So are you trying to edge in on on our turf?
Well, I was about to tell you why it's different. So this podcast is obviously quite a weekly news focus on what's been going on. We're deliberately taking a slightly longer view. So we're taking like a theme a week. And so last week it was B2B publishing. This week it's been Ukraine. And next week will be to do with the duopoly. So we're sort of having one interview and sort of a bit of discussion about that interview each week. So hopefully it'll be something that people in the industry find useful. So that's The Future of Media Explained, if you type that into wherever you get your podcast.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks both. And we'll see you both soon.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the show this week. If it's the first time you found us, remember that you can, of course, like the others said, subscribe or follow this show in the place where you get all the rest of your podcasts. There's other ways to support the show too. You can become a Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/mediapod. Sign up there. Very inexpensive. You can choose the price that suits you, and you still get access to all of the goodies, and that helps us make the show. And if you're in the lookout for some software for recording audio and video conversations, why not use riverside.fm? That's what we use. And if you use the code MEDIAPOD when you take out a riverside.fm trial, we get a bit of a kickback. So if you're looking for software, do go and try out riverside.fm and use the code MEDIAPOD. My name's Matt Deegan. The producer was Phoebe Adler-Ryan with support from Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio production. We'll see you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.